Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota legislative session begins today with Governor Kristi Noem's State of the State address. You can tune in to the session and that address live from the State House of Representatives at 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain. It's on SDPB Radio right here. You can also find it on SDPB TV and online at SD.net. Well, we're bringing you live coverage and analysis throughout the legislative session. We'll follow the bills and the debates and the appropriations. But before it's fully underway, we wanted to pause and go back to the basics of language and definitions and how politicians use words to evoke an emotional response. On January 8th, Governor Kristi Noem was published in The Federalist. She condemned the violence in the U.S. Capitol the day before. She said the Republican Party had failed Americans and that that needed to change. She called the incoming Democratic senators from Georgia communists. She said that few American children have been taught the history of our decades-long fight to defeat communism. Well, today we're going to check in on a few basic definitions as we move ahead on that legislative session. How do we define communism, socialism, fascism, authoritarianism? Well, joining us for that conversation, we welcome Nicholas Drummond. He is Assistant Professor of History and Political Science at Black Hills State University. Dr. Drummond, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Good morning.
This is not new to you, and I'm sure you have many students who come into your class confused about some of these definitions. The political rhetoric is always high. It seems particularly high right now. So first I want to ask you, like, how important are shared definitions in politics, do you think? Like, where do you want to begin with that?
Yeah, where do you begin? You know, words are fluid. I was thinking about this today. We may be reaching a point in time where words like socialism mean something far different than they used to. Think about the word liberal and how different it is. Once we used to associate this with something like individual rights, probably something more akin to libertarianism. But now liberal certainly seems to mean something more than that. And I think socialism may be evolving. And this is true not simply in terms of how politicians use the word, but when Gallup and Pew, actually some interesting studies, have shown that there are more people identifying as socialism or viewing it favorably. But when you ask them, well, what does that mean? You know, this isn't your grandfather's socialism. This isn't the economic, the government's control of the economy. It has something more to do with equality, fairness, and maybe government doing more for people and services. So I wonder if these terms, you know, terms, words change, the meaning change, and we may be seeing that happening before our very eyes with socialism.
So one of my questions is, you know, from a practical application standpoint, is that a really good way to begin a conversation with someone who you might disagree with or who might, you know, kind of trigger an emotional response? Hey, when you say that word, what do you mean by it? And really then listen. It seems like a good way to start. Yeah.
I probably ran the wrong way with that. So I think what you have in mind, the concern is that what we're doing is maybe a form of character assassination. We're trying to delegitimize someone's political views, right? If you call them a socialist or a Nazi, you're essentially saying that, look, you are beyond the pale, right? I'm not going to give you the benefit of the doubt that maybe what you say is wrong, but you mean well. I'm not even going to give you the benefit of the doubt there. You're just someone I'm not going to treat seriously at all. And I think that does happen too often in politics. We tend to try to shut down conversations or to push someone, again, beyond the pale by saying, look, you're a socialist, you're a Nazi, you're a bad, evil person. And yeah, I think that happens far too often.
Yeah. Let's talk about the word communism. What exactly is it?
Yeah, good question. Complicated because Marx and Engels themselves weren't always clear on this. Communism and socialism get used interchangeably at times. Let's start with socialism. Socialism probably boils down to a kind of government control of the economy, in particular what Marx has called the means of production. So factories, farming, the machines. And communism, many see socialism, Marxists would say that it's a necessary stage you must pass through before you get to communism, where you get into this question of property and maybe property rights and no need to have that because the workers, the people will own everything in a kind of collective ownership. That's kind of the economic academic interpretation of communism and socialism, which is different than Marxism. Marxism includes those things, encompasses those things, but also offers a kind of narrative of world history. The history is a struggle of classes. in particular economic classes, and there is a ruling class that dominates and uses ideology, its control of the ideology to legitimize itself as the ruling class. So that's kind of the Marxism, socialism, communism. Those are the terms and how I would best define them for you.
What about this notion of democratic socialism? When you take someone like Bernie Sanders, who self-identifies as democratic socialist, and has been called all kinds of other things, what do we mean when we say democratic socialism?
Well, what do we mean? What should we mean? I think we look at policies instead of words and labels and what they connote. What the policies are, or what, an expansion of Medicare, the Green New Deal, maybe healthcare, college education, daycare, these types of things. Really kind of New Deal, but maybe expanding that upon that, New Deal policies, which really makes things complex, I think, in terms of a political conversation, because there are these programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that maybe also could be considered a part of that. But would we call that socialism or democratic socialism? I don't know. Right, there's a lot of these gray areas now. It's very difficult to talk about politics.
Right. A little Adam Smith and capitalism, and him talking about sort of the purity of capitalism being bad for people and that there would have to be checks on it. So tell us a little bit about capitalism, what it is at its core, and some of the criticisms and celebrations of it.
I think the celebrations are that the free market, when you leave people alone, the idea, the hope is that it will work more efficiently than would a kind of planned economy, right? Division of labor, letting people choose their jobs, letting people try things out. There'll be winners, there'll be failures. When there's failures, move out of the way, let someone enter that space with a more effective business model. But that ultimately will lead to greater productivity than would a planned economy. And there's, I think, a really, if we think about the spirit of capitalism, there's an emphasis on rugged individualism, that individuals, they have the capacity to succeed if they work hard. And when we think about the critique of capitalism, maybe the market doesn't always lead us to a better place, or maybe there are times when people are down on the luck and it's through no fault of their own. Right? There are bad things that happen in people's lives and they do need assistance.
So, Nicholas, I have this question, and I'm wondering, you know, we're talking about Marx and other philosophers, we're talking about Adam Smith. Why do we go back that far? I mean, are there current, thinkers that have vastly different definitions, or are all our conversations founded on people like Karl Marx or Adam Smith or others?
I suspect so, and maybe it's because if we get back to the political arena, these individuals have baggage. And maybe it's really an indictment of our education system that Americans don't know much about history. But we do know that Stalin was bad, Mao was bad, Hitler was bad. And we will then use these terms, communism, Nazi, and we throw them around at each other, probably far too casually, without precision. And I wonder if that's to our detriment, right? We want to take these terms seriously, know what they mean, and know what they connote. And again, Americans today, we just throw these things around too casually, perhaps.
Yeah. I'm reminded of some of the rhetoric now. I've said this a few times already with, 4 years ago and people comparing Donald Trump to Mussolini. And one of the concerns that people had then and that people who dislike Joe Biden is this concept of a slippery slope, or this concept of if we do this in the days ahead, like we're holding the line against something in the future, even though there are clear distinctions between all these people and the people they're being compared to in history. So I just want to ask you about some of those comparisons and how they're shorthand for political action, or their umbrella terms for, this is how we trigger an emotional response in people. How are these terms and comparisons sort of leveraged in that way?
Well, I think probably authoritarianism, right? When someone accuses, what you're doing is fascist, right? It harkens back to Nazis or Mussolini or Marx, Mao. What you're doing is you're assuming too much power, you're abusing that power, I think maybe in that sense it's effective, and it does alarm people in a way that maybe they should be. Maybe we ought to be alarmed about abuses of liberty, abuses of power, and it's one way to get people to sit up a little bit taller in their chairs and pay attention. But certainly it can be abused.
Yeah. When students come in, you know, you're teaching political science and history at a time when there's a whole lot to talk about and what's happening in the world today. What are some of the questions that they ask you, and what are some of the ways that you see, you know, the way they think about government shifting?
Well, I just had my first class today, and they were a little shy, a little timid, but they will start asking those questions as the semester continues. I think on their minds more than anything is really the COVID and what this is doing in terms of their job opportunities, what that's looking like, and what should government do or not do to help them. I think that's probably front and center on their minds. They see their future in this economy as being uncertain. And that's something I want them to think about. I want them to realize that there used to be this kind of intergenerational compact where every generation would make things better for the next generation. Right? It was kind of, my parents helped me, and it's going to be a better America waiting for me. But that isn't what's waiting for these kids. Probably starting with the millennials, and even now more so with the I generation, or whatever we're calling these kids, Zoomers. I think that compact has been broken, and they need to pay attention. They need to tune in and realize that their future is on shakier ground than it's ever been before for previous generations and in modern history. So,
do you think that is making them more politically engaged or politically active at this point? Are you seeing signs?
I hope so.
Yeah.
What I think is making them more politically engaged is this generation is the first where the internet is all they've ever known. They can't imagine a world without it, and they are constantly plugged in and wherever they go, right? Social media, YouTube, TikTok is the new one. They are encountering politics all the time, right? Even if they don't want to. I suspect some of them don't want to. They'd rather check out of politics and kind of just put it to the side, but it's everywhere now, for good or for worse. It's pervasive, and what that means for this generation, we'll see. I think it will. They're going to be an interesting, very interesting generation, the Zoomers.
Yeah. TikTok is fascinating to me, and how it's being used for entertainment, and then also for, again, that political shorthand, and how pervasive it is just in, you know, 6 seconds, 9 seconds, what can be communicated.
I got off Twitter years ago because I noticed because I was on there and I was used to reading these short, very short little writings on politics, that I didn't like to read longer stuff. I had adjusted to this kind of very quick way of here's what's going on, here's what to think about it. And I said, no, I don't want this. I want to be able to read long books, and my reading comprehension was suffering because of that. So maybe that is one of the concerns with the I generation, is they want it quick. What's going on? Give it to me, and I'm going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I see an incredible sense of humor as well. Just everything's funny. Everything's funny to this generation. I mean, I shouldn't say everything's funny. Let me be clear. They can find humor in places that I don't believe my generation would have found humor. And they can do it in these really sort of deft, well-maneuvered ways. And I find that intriguing and kind of inspiring. Take yourself a little less. You know, I'm Gen X. We just checked out at some point, and they're engaged, but they're engaged wryly. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Sorry to interrupt you. In the absence of that, the Zoomer generation might be the Doomer generation. Right? If they didn't have that comedy to go to and to make light of things, then, right? I mean, imagine growing up in this world now, social media pressures, COVID. I mean, what a time to be a child or a young person. I have a lot of sympathy for these kids and what they're going through. So, yeah.
So that takes me back to something that the governor's been talking about, which is, I'm not picking on the governor because we hear it a lot, which is what kids learn these days and what kids don't learn these days, which is something every generation says about the generation that comes after. But there is this sense of what history do we know so as not to repeat it? What do they understand about politics, and what do we understand about their actual lives? Do you feel like there is great concerns for, education in South Dakota, K through 12, as far as how students come to you prepared to learn?
Well, this is my third year in South Dakota, so I'm probably not the best person to ask. I'm still gauging that. At BHSU, we have a lot of first-generation students attending college, and they're great, right? They're eager to learn. They're here. They want an education. But I think, and this is probably true of everywhere, there may not be the deep appreciation of knowledge itself. I think for many students, it's, I want that piece of paper so I can go get that job. But, you know, what keeps me teaching is we do get those golden students who, wow, I mean, they're not only learning what I put in front of them, they bring stuff to me. Right? When you have students who are engaged and they're hunting things down and they send you an email, hey, Professor Drummond, look at this. This is interesting. I mean, wow, that is what keeps me going every day, is those types of students who are fully engaged, excited about what's going on, and enthusiastically pursuing politics. So,
yeah. Before I let you go, any other terms that you think that you're seeing used casually or without precision that you really think people should pay attention to, know this word before you sling it?
Nothing comes to mind. I think we hit the ones. Just the casual use of socialism, Nazi, fascist, authoritarianism. There may be kernels of truth, but I think when people stop and appreciate the full meaning of these terms in historical context, that, you know, something's lost there. Maybe these aren't the best words to use.
Yeah. Nicholas Drummond is Assistant Professor of History and Political Science at Black Hill State University. Professor Drummond, thank you for being here today. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.